It's Season 3, Episode 5 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Gita Pensa. Welcome back, everybody. It is February 2026. It has been quite a winter around these parts. I really hope that we get to thaw out soon. And I got completely knocked out for a week by the flu. That has not happened in many, many years. You can probably still tell that I sound a little nasal here, but I'm just so glad to feel human again and to be back here with you and to have a voice at all, because I did not have one for quite a few days there. And we're ready for another episode. So in our last episode, The Educated Defendant, you heard from Dr. Nirav Patel, a radiologist who made this really strong choice early in his case. And instead of leaning into anger and avoidance and shame, he made this tactical decision to learn about the law and legal performance. And that decision fundamentally shaped the whole trajectory of his experience. So if you have not heard that episode, I really need you to start there first. There's just so much to learn from it. And I know I pound all the time that everything could change if all of us became expert about the process and how to perform in it. That's why I do this podcast. That's why I thank you for sharing these episodes with your colleagues who need to hear them. That's why I've made the LEAP courses. We all have so much to learn, and it's not hard. It's just that we've not had access to the information, or we've been avoiding it because we deep down feel like it's too scary or shameful, or it makes us too anxious, whatever. But when we do learn it, everything blows wide open. Everything changes. So we had lots to learn from Dr. Patel, and today we are going to the other major character in that story, the other side of that partnership. So joining me is John E. Hall Jr., who is a founding partner at the national firm Hall Booth Smith. He is an elite trial attorney who is the attorney who was brought in to assist local counsel for Dr. Patel's trial. John has decades of courtroom experience, and he is here to talk about what he saw in that case, what made it strong, and what we can all learn from it. So in addition to his tireless defense work, John is also a songwriter and author of multiple books, fiction and nonfiction, and his recent nonfiction book called Reviving Fairness, Defending Healthcare Heroes, is going to be the subject of next month's podcast. So John is coming back to talk to all of us about some of the principles in that book and ways that we can try to level the playing field in this ever increasingly predatory legal environment. But today, in this conversation, we're going to focus on John's views on Dr. Patel's case, what makes a defendant an asset to their defense team, and how all of us can get the most out of the attorney-client relationship. Let's get right into it. John Hall, I am so excited that you made the time. I know you are a very, very busy man to come and be on the podcast to talk with us about what you do. We've got a lot of topics to talk about today, but I'm just so happy to have you here.
Same here. I really appreciate it. And thank you for all the work you do out there for the healthcare providers. It's a needed area, and I'm glad there are folks like you out there doing it.
Can you just tell the audience about what it is that you do? I said that you're a trial attorney extraordinaire, but tell us about your practice and how you spend a lot of your time professionally.
Primarily, I handle larger exposure cases involving physicians and healthcare institutions that's been sued by plaintiff's attorneys. These days, I spend a lot of my time on trial, in a trial. We call it on trial. People always have fun with that. You're on trial? Well, you know, I feel like I'm on trial, even though I'm in trial with the doctor or a hospital or a nurse. I spend a lot of my time, 20, 25 weeks a year in court, defending them in those cases. And in between, I manage the files. I overlook a team. We have a national practice, so I overlook a team that does come into a case, look at it, review it, get involved, make sure it's got a good, strong defense, work with the defendant to be sure they're prepared for it, and then get ready to go to trial. Most of these cases settle, but the truth is the only way to get a case settled and to get it settled reasonably, if that's what you want to do, is to be prepared for trial. And a lot of these cases, and I think more of them, we need to try more. That's what I do day to day.
That's awesome. And so you are actually often brought in later in the game, closer to trial, when it's apparent that a case is going to trial, then they call you in. Tell me more about that. That didn't happen in my case. Like, how do they determine, like, oh, we need John to get in here?
It's really something that's developed over the last 10 or 15 years. It was unheard of before then. People didn't think a lawyer from Georgia could go try a case in New York. and people would be very parental and going into where the areas were. But what's happened is the cases come, and frankly, defense lawyers are trying less and less cases because of the number that settle. And they want folks that have experience in coming in and trying a lot of cases, but also trying a lot of cases where there's significant both issues in terms of the medicine. Most all the lawyers around the country that do the defense work, they get into and understand the medicine. Some may not, but most do. But being able to try a case with the kind of damages that are at and what the plaintiffs are asking for, they're seeking generational wealth in these cases. They want somebody that's had experience dealing with them in those kinds of cases and ready to try it. I typically come in and work with the local attorney that's been working in the case all along, and our team will come in and assist them, give them better resources. It's sort of like we do the surgery together as we go along.
Well, people will have heard of you already, even if they don't live in this world, if they've listened to the podcast with Dr. Patel. And I'm going to tell everybody at this point, if you have not heard that yet, I want you to start with Dr. Patel's interview. But you were the trial attorney in Dr. Patel's case. And I just find this so interesting in terms of how he educated himself. And really, I say that, like, that is what I wound up doing, but I didn't figure it out until like 8 years into my whole legal odyssey. He picked up pretty soon, like, the best way for him to help himself was to start learning about the law and tort law and legal performance and how to be a better defendant. And he studied what plaintiff's attorneys do. He read plaintiff's attorneys books and did all that in this attempt to just like, all right, how can I be my own best advocate? How can I be the best witness I could possibly be? Which I think paid a lot of dividends. How was Dr. Patel different from most medical defendants you encounter?
You know, and it's a wide variety. I'll say he's in the top 1% of people that dedicated personal time, energy, and effort in being ready for all aspects of the case. A lot of times when you get sued, folks, and we tell them to some extent, they want to compartmentalize it because we need you out there practicing and doing your practice while we're doing all the stuff we do. And by the way, law is notoriously hurry up and wait. Nothing happens quickly, especially in the discovery and even in the trial phases of going through. But what Dr. Patel did is really commit to not only knowing the medicine, knowing his case, knowing his record, knowing the depositions, knowing the other people in the case, which that's really sort of the gold standard. If I can get somebody to do that, I can go work with them to try the case. But he wanted to understand the system and the process. And in this case, it turned out to be a great help because this plaintiff's lawyer is particularly dishonest and particularly disgusting in so many different ways. But, you know, lawyers should be bound by telling the truth, but in crossing him, they misrepresented facts, misrepresented issues. And he not only dealt with those factual issues, but he didn't tolerate it. He said, no, I'm not going to do that. And he just defended himself. And in this day and age, I think jurors and certainly us lawyers love to see somebody who can defend themselves without being angry or arrogant. And he didn't. He just did, hey, I'm doing my best. And you're asking me that question in a way that you know it's not possible for me to answer. Let me tell the jury what I want to tell them. And he just did a very, very good job.
I'm really curious. I know that he had ideas about his defense and he wanted to aid in the strategy of his own defense. I'm sure that sometimes doctors want to drive the bus, but they don't actually understand how to. They want to be in control. They want to make decisions, but they don't know enough to do that. What was it about Dr. Patel? You didn't have that much time with him before you went to trial, like you came on sort of later in the case. What was it about him that made you realize, like, hey, this guy really gets it? And he tells a story about the PowerPoint presentation, which is not typical at all for a case. And you were, the way he describes it, like, nope, 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 nope. And then all of a sudden you're like, I get it. I see it. We're going to use it. Let's do it. What was it about him that you could trust him?
You know, that week or two before you get to trial, you get to know each other pretty well. And you were talking about driving the bus. I see it as a bus with two steering wheels and we're both driving. It's not one of us or the other. It's going to be both of us. And if you have one doctor trying to drive the bus, you're going to get in trouble. If you got a lawyer trying to drive the bus, you're going to get in trouble. It needs to be a collaborative partnership in terms of doing it. And I saw immediately he was very willing to spend the time to come in and sit there and go through it and walk through the case and do the homework that we had. And then he was also creative about it. His PowerPoint, just to give you an idea, his PowerPoint he put together was certainly a grand rounds lecture that somebody might do, but it was 100 slides, and you can't go stand up in front of a jury and lecture them for 45 minutes on why you believe about the case. And I had to get him to understand that. And then once I got him to understand that, he understood I had to be part of it. We had to co-drive the bus. We could use the PowerPoint, taking out some of the additional things, but we cut it down to the essence of what the defense was. And I said, okay, here's how we're going to do it. You're not going to get up there and lecture 45 minutes. The judge won't let you do that. But I'm going to put up your PowerPoint and I'm going to ask you questions. And you actually listen to me and answer my question instead of going to the next slide. And then I'll take you to the next slide. And then you explain the slide. It became a dance. It's one of those things where we both don't want to step on each other's toes. I think when most people get in court, they get very anxious. I think most lawyers get very anxious. They don't listen to the answers, and the witnesses don't listen to the questions. You just have in mind what you're going to do. When I saw that he would listen to me and would let me drive it with him together to go through that point, then I knew that he was going to do well, and his PowerPoint was excellent. We would have used it. What we initially started out with when I first saw it with the link, and I thought, well, I could use this section and that section and this section. He really sat down and knew how to nail it down and narrow it down. I believe there's a lot of turning points in every case, but it was certainly a very significant case in the jury understanding the medicine, but more importantly, understanding that he understood the medicine and he cared about it.
Okay. That's actually a really interesting thing to draw out of it. I know what was a really pivotal moment for him in trial, where you really understood exactly what he was laying down in terms of his argument about the medicine. And he told a story about how at some point it was all really coming together. And you got up from the defense table for, I don't remember what your next move was, if you were crossing someone or what was happening. I don't recall. And maybe you do, maybe you don't. But he said, you turned to him, you'd had a conversation, you totally got it. And you turned back and said to him, fastball down the middle. And then you got up and you did your thing. And that moment for him was just this, he had so much trust in you and so much faith in you. And you really, really like, I mean, no one ever knows what's going to happen, but he really felt like you got it. It could have been just a passing comment from you.
No, I remember it.
Everything to him. Tell me about that moment.
His presentation, the plaintiff had put him up in Georgia where this case was tried. A plaintiff can put the doctor up, ask them questions for an hour, 2 hours, and I don't get to ask them questions then. And he had already been prepared and gotten through that part of the process and did a great job. And we'd worked with him and he ended up doing great. He really showed that he knew what he did and he spoke and talked to the plaintiff's lawyer. So next, the plaintiff's lawyers put up their experts and he's like the kid in the candy store, you know, that just got this new toy and he wants to show everybody. And he keeps wanting me to know, it's in the power. You know this, and you got to talk to him about this. And I just looked at him and said, I got it. Fastball down the middle. I'm going to hit it out of the park. And walked up and cross-examined the guy, used his PowerPoint on the cross-examination, used the points that we had discussed. And from that point over, the entire trial up to that point, the two of us were two very dedicated, passionate people working toward a goal that we wanted to accomplish. And after that cross, and he saw me use that discussion, we became one person in two people's world working together to win this trial.
I mean, that's amazing. That's amazing. I hate to say it. I don't think that every defendant gets the feeling that their attorney has invested enough time or interest or attention or understanding of the medicine to defend them with that degree of confidence. What, I mean, our listenership is mostly doctors. Sometimes attorneys do listen, but what would you say to trial attorneys in terms of how much preparation a witness needs, a defendant needs to be an effective witness, to do well in this arena? What should physicians do if they feel like they want more from their attorney?
Yeah, you know, I think probably the biggest loss in these cases is that you come in and you meet a doctor early. Doctor sets aside an hour with him. You go through the complaint. You talk about the medicine. We're going to get together. We'll prep before your depo. I think the medical profession and the legal profession have to change given what the plaintiff's lawyers are doing. I think we need to go ahead and prepare ourselves for trial within the first month of the case. And that means the doctor taking time to go read the information that we have for them and us to read the information they have. And we jointly talk about who our experts are going to be and where it, that's not the standard. That's not the norm. But I do believe if we can get that, it's going to be a better experience for the lawyers and the doctors in the long run as we go through this challenging time. It is a changing time in the medical legal world where greed and money and dishonesty is pushing the system to its limits. And if the defense lawyers don't just get along with the plaintiff's lawyer and just do one, two, three, because I always do one, two, three, if we don't change that and start mixing it up. And I think one of the key ways is early on getting the doctor to commit or the nurse to commit into those cases. And it's easier said than done. There's so much emotional overlay that you take time and try to figure out and try to go through. But doctors ought to insist on regular meetings. First, they ought to demonstrate they want to know. I know very few lawyers who will tell a defense lawyer that'll tell a doctor, no, I don't want to meet with you and I don't want to spend an hour or 2 hours with you talking about this. They're willing to do that if the doctor lets them know. I think the convention is they're not willing to ask for that time early because they don't want to interfere with the doctor and the doctor doesn't ask because they want to interfere with the lawyer. But I think we need to do that. And then along the way, there's all these opportunities. Dr. Patel was very great about, he went to expert depositions. And most doctors won't exercise that right. You've got a right. If I have somebody going to criticize me, I want to sit aside the table and look at him while he does it or look at her while she gives her opinions. Dr. Patel did that. He made the difference that way. And I knew he was in the top 1% when he was working to do that with the lawyers working the case up. And so when it got to us, he was already in that mindset. It was an interesting, good period.
Yeah. So actually, I want to ask you about that. Like he did mention that he went to these depositions. Certainly no one offered that to me. I think that when we're not empowered and we don't understand the process, we don't know that we could do that if we wanted to. Obviously, we need to be able to sort of handle ourselves and our own emotions sitting in that room. There's like a lot of value to be gained by that. That was something really surprising to me. Is that something that you, knowing that now, would recommend for defendants who feel emotionally capable of handling that?
No, we do that, and we offer the folks the chance to do that. Life goes on. If I'm going to take a deposition in California, it's hard for a doctor, depending on their practice area, and most of you are in amazing practice areas, it's hard to go sit aside 2 days and go out there and deal with this issue or take a day or even a day and a half to get that side. So I think it's just one of those things. We're okay if we don't do that. But if somebody wants to do that and it's going to help contribute to it, I think it's a great thing to do. It's really individual. And I will tell folks, even following just sort of the 1-2-3 way people tend to defend cases, it still comes to the right conclusion in the end. Usually people get together and they have the ability to prep the case and those issues. But absolutely along the way is more involvement better. And I think physicians need to stand up and decide what's best for them. I know some doctors that would have been devastated by going to depositions. It would have thrown us up, down, and we would have been working to deal with all those things going through. And others would be very good at doing it like Dr. Patel did. And I think the team's got to sit down and look, okay, what's right for you? And then make it work. It really is. Medicine's an art, not a science. Law is an art, not a science. There's not one thing that fits everybody. It's got to be what that situation is and what the relationship is.
Phenomenal. Any last words about this case that'll have heard from Dr. Patel? You put him in that top 1% and you've worked with many, many, many medical defendants in the past. If we could take something out of his story of something that we could sort of, you know, in our own cases as we move forward, what would you like us to try to emulate out of that?
I think number one is preparation. Know your case. And to the extent that you have genuine curiosity and you want your attorney to have genuine curiosity and you want to dig deeper into it, dig deeper and let your attorney know you're doing that and invite them along. They'll travel in with you. You know, I think the attorneys ought to be a little more aggressive at getting the doctors involved, but certainly the doctors need to be more involved in doing it. So I take that out of that is psychologically, if it helps you get in there and help your defense, it's going to help your defense. Your defense will be good without it. You know, you're going to feel better about it if you jump in there and you're part of the process. So I urge people to do. I urge them to know they have the absolute right. And I urge them not to. I go to doctors as a patient. I don't ask any questions. Heck, I take medications that, heck, most of them, I don't even know what they do. I don't even look them up because I just do what my doctor tells me. And that's bad. I'm a bad patient. Unfortunately, doctors are bad patients too, is they just go in and do what the lawyer tells them and they don't ask questions. Ask questions. Get in there and passionately ask. And I always have to throw in a caveat, unless for you, by creating the wall that the lawyer will allow you to create, you don't have to deal with it except when they 4 or 5 periods of time up until the time of trial, and that's better for you, then fine. Don't feel bad if you don't do that. But if you're feeling better and you're wanting to contribute, speak up, ask questions, and make people give you answers. And the last thing I'll say, in that case, the plaintiff's expert, in my mind, was despicable. And I think I challenge all of you doctors out there and nurses that, A, testify. Unfortunately, these cases involve millions of dollars and the fees for an expert of $50,000, $100,000 fees. They get in there and they forget to look at the case and think, okay, the question is, was this conduct unreasonable? Not proper perfection. Nurses are the worst. Nurses second guess other nurses to a degree of perfection that nobody practices at.
Oh, you mean nursing experts?
Nurse experts, yeah. And doctor experts do the same. Oh, well, you know, here with my institution, we do it. Well, sure you do. Right. But let me tell you, let's look at this case and let's look at it at what is reasonable conduct. And I think the profession will be better if everybody, both on the experts from the defense side who's reviewing the cases or experts who are acting from the plaintiff's side, that they just be honest with that and not get seduced by the process of going beyond where you ought to be. And the other thing is, I think you have to clean up your own house. I think you've got doctors that are saying stupid and ridiculous things in exchange for money that need to be sanctioned. The court system, remember, most judges are funded by plaintiff's lawyers. So I don't have a whole lot of help from judges on trying to sanction these kind of people.
Say that again. That is something that we don't know.
Oh, most judges in this country are elected. Most state court judges, which is where all medical malpractice cases typically fall. There are a few federal, but most of them are state. Most of those judges are elected. They're elected in a county. And within that county, the number one contributor around the country on average to judicial campaigns are plaintiff's lawyers. So they're contributing to the campaigns. And that's one thing to get good to know, too. I go to a bunch of different counties around the country. I always want to know how much money the plaintiff's lawyer gave the judge. And it's a matter of record, so I can go find that out and know if that's going to be an issue for me. But back to the point is that if you're going to have professional associations, call yourselves fellows and go to a bunch of meetings, then why not police those people within your profession who are getting up and saying something that 99.99% of you know is not true?
You are singing my song, John Hall. I feel very passionately about this, as people do.
You'll have to remind folks to go to Spotify and look under Law, L period, A period, W period, Love and Water. I write music, my songs are on Spotify.
That's true, Greg. When I say you're singing my song, I mean, John, I'm going to have you back because we're going to talk about your book, Reviving Fairness. But just as we're wrapping this one up, like, I got to ask you about, how do you find the time for all this stuff? Because you write songs. And I've heard a couple, they're marvelous. I should probably listen more. You can tell us where to find those. But you just wrote a fiction novel, right?
Yeah, I've written 3. My last one that came out is called AI Lies and Murder. It's about a hospital AI that is with the patient. When you walk in the door, you meet your AI. It stays with you. It's available for you 24 hours a day. You wake up at 3 a.m. and say, what's my blood pressure? It'll tell you. It manages your care. And a venture capital company wants to buy it from the hospital group that developed. They don't want to sell it. Next thing you know, the hospital CFO's in the hospital and dies, and his wife and the police prosecute the hospital and the AI for murder.
Oh, gosh.
It's pretty cool. It's on Amazon. It's called AI Lies and Murder.
AI Lies and Murder. All right. I cannot wait to read it. And I cannot wait to have you back, John, because we're going to talk about Reviving Fairness and what you're doing to support the whole defense side in terms of adapting to this new reality that we find ourselves in. Thank you.
I look forward to it. Thanks for letting me do this. And by the way, you go out and speak to lawyers, helping us understand what goes. And I want to thank you for that, too, and hope you'll continue to help me along those lines.
Oh, gosh, you know, it's my pleasure. So I will talk to you again soon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you again to John E. Hall Jr., senior partner at Hall Booth Smith, nationally recognized trial lawyer, and author of Reviving Fairness, Defending Healthcare Heroes, which is going to be the topic of next month's podcast. We are going to talk with John about his new book, and can't wait for it.